You're listening to Empower, the show that inspires you to live your best life with peace and purpose. Here is your host, Clayton Morris.
Hey everyone, Clayton Morris back with another episode of the Empower Podcast. You know, the response was so great from our first interview with Dr. Rick Hansen. We talked about hardwiring happiness and how we can actually make small changes to our brain and to our lives to create happiness in our lives. We don't have to make dramatic changes. We can do it pretty simply, actually. So we decided, Rick and I, that we should have another episode targeting fear and anxiety. In fact, we were going to try to get to it in the first episode, but we just had too much fun talking about happiness. We didn't actually get to it. But fear and anxiety is something that plagues, you know, all of us, plagues me. It's been a huge problem in my life, and I'm sure for a lot of you, it's been a huge problem as well. So we decided to devote an entire episode to figuring out how to remove fear and anxiety from our life. Well, we can't really get rid of fear. We can actually use it to our advantage, though, sort of like an animal instinct. So that's what today's episode is all about. Dr. Rick Hansen is back once again to talk about anxiety and fear, and I think you're really going to love this episode. I had one huge, huge takeaway, which I'm now noticing anytime that I sort of freeze in my steps. Wait till you get to that part in this episode. I'm super excited to share it with you. Sit back and enjoy part two of my interview with Dr. Rick Hansen. Rick, welcome back to the show.
Clayton, it's a pleasure to be here again.
I'm thrilled to have you back. Your first time on the show, we talked obviously more generally about how we hardwire happiness in our brains. But one of the things that you and I think really connected on is this whole idea around fear and anxiety. And we thought, you know what? That deserves its own whole entire show. So today, we're going to talk all about fear and anxiety and how we can nip it in the bud.
Sounds great.
Sound like a plan?
Oh, it's fear is pervasive, and it's such a primal emotion, and it hits us in this range from very subtle uneasiness, apprehensiveness, you know, tension, feeling unsettled. Then you move toward being really worried about something, you know, and then you start even moving toward feeling frozen or immobilized, a sense of dread, all the way out to panic. So this whole territory, especially the more subtle ends of that spectrum that are so pervading for so many people, it's such an important subject to talk about because it makes us suffer, but it also makes us sometimes act in ways that are problematic because if we feel threatened, then we lash out at others and so forth.
I want to define, I think you maybe just did, but we'll get a little bit more clinical, I suppose. I want to, though, before we even really define anxiety and define define fear. I want to kind of give people a little bit of ray of hope here right off the top of the show in that something you had said before we jumped on the call, which is that fear is exciting. And you said it's exciting. And I want to ask you why you think it's exciting.
Oh, well, I for one, when we're frightened, we tend to get revved up, right? So in that basic sense, it's exciting. But in the sense of exciting, good. To me, fear is a wonderful topic to pursue because so many people, me included, have fears that are not useful. We want useful fear, right? We also want to be usefully cautious. And it's an important point that you can feel cautious or determined to take care of something without feeling anxiety at the same time. Say you're driving in traffic, you've got two big trucks on either side of you, and it's raining. You want to be cautious, but you don't need to get panicked about being sandwiched between these two trucks.
Right.
And this, yeah, and the same is true in other settings. So it's a big issue. And second, of all the psychological maladies of various kinds, I think that generally speaking, fear is one of the most deeply studied, and arguably it's the one that has the most practical things that you can do about it. So in that sense, it's exciting as well, because this topic is full of hope.
That's great. So that's the ray of sunshine I wanted to give to people right off the top, that the reason you think it's so exciting is because we can nip it in the bud pretty easily. We're going to walk through some very practical things we can do to fix fear and anxiety a little bit later in the show. But first, I want to kind of lay the groundwork and start off with really defining, maybe even from a clinical perspective, what anxiety really is. If someone's sitting at home thinking, you know, these drug commercials are great, right? Because they have these cartoon characters and they get us to go out and talk to our doctors because we think that that's what it is, right?
Right.
How do we really know that we're suffering from anxiety and fear? How would you define it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we want to distinguish between reasonable anxiety, you know, realistic, proportionate anxiety. If you're, you know, in the middle of a combat zone and they're shooting at you, right? Or you just got a diagnosis from your doctor about a serious illness for yourself or your child, let's say, of course you're going to be anxious about that. If your boss, for some reason, says, look, got to give you bad news, it's 50-50 that we're going to have to lay you and 1,000 other people off in a month. So, you know, just want to give you a heads up. You know, it's appropriate to be anxious about that. Mm-hmm. What you and I are focusing on, though, is what you could call excess suffering. In other words, needless, useless, in fact, often harmful worry, apprehension, ruminating, dread, panic, unease, tension in the body, and so forth. That's what we're focusing on. And so what I would say about that is that the key question to ask yourself is, you know, is my anxiety adding any value here, right? Or am I just looping through, going around the same track of worrying and worrying and worrying about something without moving it forward? Or am I worrying, you know, on the 0 to 10 worry scale, am I worrying like a 7 or an 8 about a problem that's objectively a 1 or a 2? You know, in the worst case, it's just a 1 or a 2. It's not that big a deal. But am I worrying about it out of proportion to how bad it really is? And also, am I missing resources that could take care of this problem? A lot of people worry about things, but they don't take action. They don't do reasonable things within the resources they have and the life that they have, make a plan, go forward, take care of the problem. So that's problematic anxiety. That's bad anxiety. That's anxiety that doesn't help you or anybody else.
Okay, so problematic anxiety is what we're really talking about here. Yeah, because if a bear is attacking you, you're not really dwelling on it. You're not thinking about it. You're really just acting.
Yes. Like, for example, we worry a lot about what other people are thinking about us,
right?
For example. It's classic. Modern life, we're not usually being chased by bears or saber-toothed tigers, whatever, or barbarians with spears. But we worry about what other people think about us. So just take that as an example. One thing I myself have done, because I do worry a lot about what other people think about me. I grew up in a home, both my parents, bless them, no longer alive, very loving, decent people who also were fault-finding and very critical. So I was always on the bubble as the oldest of three kids. You know, what fault is going to be found with me today, unfairly usually, or way out of proportion how bad it really was, okay? What I've come to realize, though, as an adult, is that even though that worry about what other people think about me is, you know, it's normal, a lot of people have it, nothing to be ashamed of. On the other hand, number one, I have very limited influence over what people think about me. And just recognizing that has made me calmer. So two, I do what I can, which mostly shows up around trying to do a good job. You know, don't be evil, as they say at Google, you know, be reasonably kind and rash, you know, cooperative with other people. But after that, once you make your own offering, once you do what you can in a situation, it doesn't add value to keep worrying about what they think about you because it's literally out of your control. If I go on an airplane, I can't control whether it crashes. And, you know, I help myself come to peace with the possibility that a bad thing might happen for me and other people on the plane. I don't want it to happen. I don't intend it to happen. But I recognize that I can't stop it from happening. So, you know, if I'm upset about the plane taking off and I'm worried in the whole flight, that's not adding any value. It's not keeping the plane in the air, you know?
Right.
And if anything, irrational worry, needless worry crowds out rational worry. Oftentimes people don't worry enough about things that are actually important, you know, like not getting enough exercise or drifting apart in their marriage, say, or their teenager who's gone totally silent at dinner and you have no idea what's going on. Those are real issues to worry about. But if we're worrying a lot about needless things, like getting preoccupied about what other people think of us, it's hard to focus on the real things that matter most.
Yeah. So let's talk about, we started our conversation, the outer world. There's these different types of anxieties, right? And we worry about, like, ISIS, right? Mm-hmm. Or, am I going to let my kids walk home from school? Because what if, God forbid, someone nabs my son or something, you know?
Yeah.
You know, or I don't want to live too close to the coast in California. God forbid there's an earthquake. Mm-hmm. You know, these, like, exterior anxieties that you say. There's not really anything we can do about them.
Right. I think you make a plan, right? And you do what you can. And then you just try to live with reality as it is. And so I think that with regard to external threats, people can, do what's possible. Go see that doctor, give thought to where your career's at, try to live in as safe a neighborhood as you can, and so forth. Cope. In other words, coping binds anxiety. And as a psychologist and as a business consultant, in both kinds of settings, I've seen people who are worried about things, but they're not taking reasonable action to do what they can about it. Hmm. They're not going to see that doctor. They're not doing that business analysis. They're not having a candid talk with someone they're supervising or who's supervising them. Whatever it might be, they're not speaking to a coach outside the system to get some advice. They're not taking action that they could take. Take the action you can.
Is a lot of the anxiety, though, that it sounds like we're making it up ourselves, really. I mean, right? I know, my wife, she was the type that would get an assignment in college and she would do it that night. Me, holy smokes, yeah. I'd wait till it was like the day or the day before it was due and I would do it. And so we know the proper course of action to cause the least amount of anxiety. For me, the anxiety would start to build up in the week before it was due. Well, if I would have just started it right when I was assigned to me, maybe I wouldn't have this anxiety.
That's right. In other words, in terms of talking here about what can help people, I think it's kind of like a pre-flight checklist. You just kind of want to check yourself. Am I doing what I can? So intervening in the outer world as best you can. Yes or no? Check. Okay, but that said, then there are lots and lots of things you can do inside yourself that can help you feel less anxious, less worried, less tense, and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. So taking those basic steps to sort of mitigate some of the outside influences. Then you say to me, like, there's, the normal, it's perfectly normal to feel anxiety. I thought that was interesting that by our very nature, the fact that we survive is because of anxiety, and then that's okay. So we shouldn't be it seems like we maybe are creating an extra layer of anxiety by worrying about anxiety.
That's really great, Clayton. You're so right. And now we're starting to move into what can you do inside yourself, right?
Right.
Flagging that checkbox. Okay, intervene out there in the world as best you can. Do what you can, it's a serenity prayer, right? Do what you can out there. That said, okay, now going inside yourself. So you're right. I think people create sort of, secondary problems for themselves, sort of like making a bad thing worse. They get stressed about worrying, or they worry that they're not worried. I've known a lot of people who get nervous about not being anxious because they're afraid that if they stop worrying so much, that somehow they will lower their guard, and that's when they'll be zapped, right? So one of the very first things is to appreciate that anxiety is pervasive. You're not the only person who feels it. I look at people walking down the street, me among them. We're all kind of scared critters.
Right.
It's okay. You don't need to, criticize yourself for being anxious, for example. Then what are you going to do about it, of course? And for me, one of the very first things to do about it, if we can start going here, is trying to relax your body. It's hard to be anxious when your body's relaxed, right? And one of the premier things that happens when we get anxious is we start revving up into fighting or fleeing, fight or flight, or we start moving toward freezing, the human equivalent of, like an animal playing dead. And in both those cases, there's tension in the body. So for one, needless anxiety is making us more needlessly stressed and tense than we need to be, we want to be, which has consequences for our physical health and our mental health and our relationships long term. And the other thing that's happening, which is great, is that if you, because of this mind-body connection, if you deliberately calm your body, like, for example, take 3 long exhalations,
right,
you know, because when you exhale, it slows your heart rate and calms your body down. Or do a regular little practice, walking the dog, Pilates, yoga, lying in bed, lying on the floor for 10 minutes and just relaxing every part of your body so that you can change the general thermostat setting of your, you know, tension level in your body, your relaxation level. So you kind of dial it down. That's your resting state. You want to get your resting state calmer and more relaxed in the body in an ongoing way. And second, if you're starting to spike, you know, needlessly, then in situations, you want to try to get your body calmer, more relaxed. And there are a whole bunch of ways that people can do that. I don't know. Do you have a favorite that helps your body calm down?
Well, I mean, because I've suffered, I mean, we can dive into this, right? Because I've suffered from anxiety and fear, you know, fear-based anxiety my whole life. And usually it comes from not taking action on something, or if I'm if I'm worried, let's say I get some bad news and I know that I need to share it with someone, or I kind of mill about and kind of push it off. I've worked over the years now to really try to identify those triggers and run towards them and get, because they dissipate. You know, that's what I try to teach my kids, which is when my son was born, I try to say to him, look, when you're experiencing fears, when you run towards those fears, they vanish, they go away. You know, and so if I can mitigate some of those fears by just going right after them, identifying those triggers and not dwelling on them, and taking action on them as quickly as possible, because then they'll fester, right? If I think about them overnight or I lose sleep over it. But just from like a physiological standpoint, for me, meditation has been a game changer for me, spending 20 minutes in the morning doing meditation and then 20 minutes in the afternoon. And I'm just incredibly calm. For the first time, I think, in my life over the past year.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you're speaking, you know, personally about a finding that's very, very common in the research, that some kind of little practice, relatively brief, right, 20, 40 minutes a day, can have that kind of impact. I think also in situations, you know, it's really helpful for people to notice, are you getting tense? And then internally, trying to dial that, I call it the stressometer, your stressometer, you know, to kind of dial it down so you're not so tense. Or do little things in the body, like I said, long exhalations, relax the tongue, relax the jaw muscles, you know, relax your feet. These are little tiny things people could do right in the middle of a meeting. Nobody needs to know you're doing it, and will calm your body down. So to me, that's first big headline, you know, or second big headline. 1, take appropriate action. 2, calm the body. That's huge.
Before we get to the calm the body, I imagine the triggers.
Yeah.
You know, is there some, I guess for everyone, are the triggers are different, or are there sort of commonalities that we could like look for before we know to curl our toes in the carpet? Are there certain things where we're saying, here we go again?
Yeah. You start feeling tense. Your breathing gets lighter and quicker. You start feeling this kind of like you're feeling sleepy, or just sort of checking out. That's kind of the mental equivalent of playing dead, the freeze response.
Really?
You start getting confused in your mind almost. The technical word is dissociative. You're a little spacey.
Huh.
You're not going into a trance state, you know, no worries. But you're just kind of going away. And either one of those is a great sign. Wow.
That is fascinating. I guess I've just always assumed, you know, fear or anxiety, you start to get nervous, shaky, but that's really, you're so right. I think about all the times in my life when I've just gotten anxious about things. You don't have clarity.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting. We normally think when people are afraid, fight or flee, right?
Right.
That makes sense. But the most, actually, if you think about it in evolution, the original coping response to threat was freezing. Because freezing evolved in our history before fighting or fleeing. So it's ancient. The neural systems, the nervous system that's involved in this kind of freeze response, including the subtleties of it that you and I are talking about, is actually really primal. It's ancient. It's the original one. So yeah, it's actually very natural that people go there. And the solution is a little different. If you're, on the one hand, getting overly tensed, right, you're into fighting or fleeing, then, needlessly fighting or fleeing, right, then the trick is to relax the body. On the other hand, if you're starting to move into that freeze response where you feel spacey, de-energized, like your energy's slumping, you're kind of collapsing in yourself a little bit, then what's great is vitality. Stand up, speak louder, do cold water on your face, bring some energy back, start mobilizing. In other words, right. The freeze response is you're immobilized, and so you want to mobilize. But the fight or flight response is you're overly tense, so you want to kind of calm and relax there. And then sometimes, of course, the worst of it is people who get stuck, like people have a trauma history in both of those. On the one hand, they feel frozen, and on the other hand, their heart is beating 100 times a minute, And then you kind of have to do both. You have to mobilize yourself to break out of the freeze and also kind of bring the body back down to some kind of calm.
That's great. That's great. So the body chemistry, I want to get to that now because, I over the past few years, the way we try to live in our family is to not eat crap. And we know that so much of, what occurs on the body, whether it's eczema or, obesity, it's all because of what we eat, right? And I would wager to guess that a lot of our anxieties in life come from the food we eat and the way that our digestion is working. And if we feel bloated or tired, it's as a result too of the things that we're putting into our body and the chemical reaction that's taking place.
I think you're very, very perceptive there, Clayton. And it's interesting. What is anxiety? Anxiety is a signal that something is wrong. Okay, so let's say you have, a Diet Coke for breakfast, and then for lunch you have, a salad with no protein or something, and then followed in the afternoon with a couple guilt-inducing cookies or donuts. Well, insulin levels will tend to rise in the beginning because, you're taking sugar and you're not taking much protein to calm it down, and then insulin crashes. You get that sugar crash. Something is wrong in your body. Or maybe you eat some food you're actually allergic to or sensitive to. You can tolerate it, but it's really not good for you. Like, let's say gluten grains or something like that. Something is wrong in your body again, And when your body feels like something is wrong, that's going to produce signals of anxiety. Much of the anxiety we feel has nothing to do with what's happening around us. It has to do with what's happening in our body, or we're kind of in our head about things. And the fact that, so much of our anxiety is based on what's happening inside us is incredibly hopeful, because then we can do something about it, just like you're saying. Be thoughtful about those things that make your body in less than tip-top shape. Do those things that help you establish a basis of, health, like exercise, things like that. And then really watch your mind. To me, that's the third big headline about what to do about anxiety. Number one, take action. Number two, calm the body. Number three, right. Check your thoughts at the door. Don't believe everything you think, for example. I have this t-shirt given to me by people who teach teenagers how to be mindful, and the t-shirt says, don't believe everything you think. So that's another area where we can intervene and realize, for example, that a lot of the things that unconsciously or semi-consciously, the chain of anxiety, the links in the chain that make us anxious, one of those major links is that we believe bad things will happen, right? Mm-hmm. But what are the odds actually of the bad thing happening? I think about this in terms of childhood. When you're a kid, bad things happen and you're stuck in them. Right? It's your family, it's your parents, it's your school district, it's your neighborhood, you're stuck. So they happen a lot, all right? Two, they hit you really hard because you're a kid. You feel things really intensely. And three, you don't have much ability to cope. You don't have internal resources, psychology, meditation, whatever, and you don't have a credit card. You can't just get a car and get out of there, right? So you don't have a lot of coping. But now as adults, You know, even though we transfer into the present that learning from childhood, and so we think, oh, if I do X, if I say what I really want or what I really think, or if I, you know, am strong with another person or something like that,
right,
a terrible thing will surely happen. Because, yeah, it surely did happen when you were a kid. But the odds of that bad event today are much lower. Or even if it did happen, right? Even if that person said that thing or that bad event occurred, how hard would it hit you? It won't hit you as hard as it did when you were a kid. So you don't need to be so worried about it in that regard. And then third, even if the bad event occurred, even if it hits you hard, right, you could still cope with it well today. Much better, certainly, than you could as a kid. So we transfer into the present lots and lots of fears that we learned or expectations or assumptions or views about ourselves, whatever, that we learned as a child. They made sense then. But today, it's like walking around in a suit of armor that's like two sizes too small. And the good news is that the likelihood of a bad event is a lot lower today than it was then. Two, it won't feel so bad. And three, you can cope with it better than you used to. And that's good news. That itself is calming. And if you kind of just think that through and you realize that it's true most of the time.
Interesting. I'm also thinking here about the recycling symbol that, you know, with the arrows going into themselves. And you talked about thoughts and feelings. And if you, so if our listeners could sort of picture that recycling symbol with the arrows feeding itself or a snake eating its own tail, that thoughts beget feelings, feelings beget thoughts. Is that okay that's the way that it all happens. Is there a way to break that cycle? Do we want to break that cycle or start using it to our advantage?
It's really natural. Like, for example, I notice that if I'm already unsettled, like I'm my emotional mood, you know, there are feelings and then there are moods. And we can have a mood of anxiety because for one, there's a natural range of temperament. Some people, their resting state is they're just more anxious than other people. You know, that's natural. So you start with that kind of like underlying mood. And then I notice that when I'm in that mood of when I'm worried about stuff, you know, deep down inside, then what will often happen is that I will start thinking in a catastrophizing way. I will imagine the worst possible scenarios. I'll overlook all kinds of things that might make life go better for me. You know, in other words, there, my mood or my feelings have produced my thoughts, have kind of shaped my thoughts. That's one of those arrows you were drawing there in that recycling symbol.
Right.
Then on the other hand, I noticed that if I have an assumption, for example, that if I, you know, do a certain thing with another person, or if they think a certain way about me, or if they say a thing about me, you know, in an organization I'm part of, that really, really bad things will happen. So if I have that thought, right, this belief, maybe transferred from my childhood, you know, that some authority figure is going to really be mean to me, or, you know, I won't have any friends, or no one will stick up for me, because that's what happened when I was a kid. But if that's my unconscious or semi-conscious assumption today, it's my expectation, my belief, whatever, it's going to make me feel more worried than I actually really, really need to feel. And so what I'll try to do, and this, there are a lot of therapeutic methods that use this approach, cognitive therapy methods. I'll try to surface in myself, what is the belief that's making me worry so much here? Is it actually true? How likely is the bad event? How could I prevent it? How could I cope with it? You know, what's really, really true? And when you see through the beliefs that make you more nervous than you really need to be, mm-hmm. it literally is like waking up from a bad dream.
Wow. I'm typing out so many notes. This is great. This is great. So let's dive in now. We sort of really laid out, I think, the scaffolding. Did we miss anything on the scaffolding before we start diving into some of the practical ways we can really start to fix it?
Yeah. I'll give you, for me, the fourth. And I love how you're doing scaffolding here. So we had take action, right? Calm the body, you know, check your thoughts. The fourth is get support. We're very, very social. Why is it that when children are scared, they want to crawl into their parents' bed or they want to, you know, like there are these studies that show preschoolers playing in the playground, they'll venture away from the home base of, let's say, mom or dad, and then they'll look back. And if mom or dad or the caregiver is still watching them, they'll go forward another 10 or 20 feet away, right? They'll explore further. But if they look back and mom or dad is actually not watching them, they'll come closer to mom or dad because they don't feel that kind of support as a secure base for themselves. So to me, a fourth headline, and then we can dive into this in whatever way you'd like, Clayton. A fourth headline is to be, is to look for human support, other people. Talk with a friend. Run your fears by somebody. Is it actually real, you know, what you're worried about? Look, even if it's not related to the fear concretely, reach out for soothing. Reach out for camaraderie. Maybe it's dark humor, like, you know, hey, we're all in the foxhole together. Our boss is insane. Laugh. Okay, go forward. But then you don't feel so frightened anymore. So I think social support is really, really important too.
That's great. So, and we have phobias too. I mean, we have all sorts of things that exist out there. When we look at, I mean, some really pronounced phobias, right, where you don't even want to leave the house, like you're agoraphobic or those sorts of things. Where does that come from?
Well, you're talking there about an extreme of a normal system, of a normal process. You know, it's normal to be nervous about certain things. Let's say you were in an elevator and the elevator, you know, got stuck and you were stuck in the elevator for 45 minutes and it was very kind of weird and scary. And after that, it would be understandable the next time you go to an elevator that, you know, you'd feel a little weird about it. But can you still get on the elevator, recognizing that, you know, 99.9999999% of the time, elevators work just fine? That's the key distinction. And so what you're talking about is where there are responses to threats that are, you know, really irrational. They're way out of proportion to what is actually the issue. And often, you know, painfully, the person will recognize this. They'll recognize that they're more freaked out about elevators or snakes than they rationally need to be, but they can't help it, right? So then what to do about it? And in a situation like that, if it's affecting a person's life, and this broader point applies, of course, to anything you and I might talk about, if it's affecting your life in a serious way, and you've maybe tried common sense things, including of the sort that you and I are discussing, and it's not budging, get professional help. You know, talk with somebody about it, sort out an approach that works for you and your situation, whatever insurance you have and so forth. But don't kid yourself. You know, these things don't tend to just go away on their own, actually. And they can become a new normal, a new way of life, like people who become kind of housebound or close to it. I've known people like that. I've worked with people like that. So that's what I'd say about those more extreme versions,
right.
Recognizing that, you know, while those are real, those really matter, there's an awful lot of unnecessary anxiety that's more in the normal range that people can actually do something about from the inside out.
When we look at fixing these problems and like a timetable, I'm an impatient kind of guy, I think, by nature. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
You know, I've known or I became aware of the fact that I, you know, have fears of money and fears of lack and worried that, you know, the tablecloth will be ripped off the table or the rug pulled out from under me at, you know, at different times, or feelings of unworthy or feelings of, you know, I'm not deserving of success, those sorts of things. So those fears, which I think can freeze me as you, that's a brilliant way to put it. And I never thought of it that way. All of those things lead to inaction or just a meandering.
Yeah,
so is there a timetable that we can sort of expect to see a turnaround once we begin employing some of the practical ways at fixing this? Are you, in your experience, is it 2 weeks? Is it a month?
It depends. That's a great question. A couple things. So first, it's interesting that a lot of the truth is that people are actually not feeling their own anxiety. If you look closely or you really talk with people and people listening can look inside themselves, are you actually letting yourself feel in your body in a normal, not, you know, California new age, weird something kind of way? Just you feel it, open to it. Are you actually feeling it? Very often what's happening is that people are flipping up into thinking. They're starting to ruminate obsessively round and round the track as a way to avoid experiencing the anxiety. But the problem is, if you don't experience it for 10, 20, 30 seconds at a time, or even a few minutes straight in a time, if you don't let it flow, as it were, that anxiety gets suppressed. It gets bottled up. And as Freud put it a long time ago, there is the return of the repressed. You know, it keeps coming back. So one of the important things I want to add here is that is to let yourself feel it. Let it flow through you. One of the best ways to get rid of anxiety is to let it flow through you. Don't act it out. You know, don't do something that's not good for you to do, but basically feel it, let it flow. And that alone will often help people feel less anxious. Plus, it's important to, you know, of course, be authentic and to, you know, be in touch with yourself. That said, if a person is, you know, let's say chronically anxious, 0 to 10, you know, they're on needless anxiety scale, they're a 7 or an 8, say, I think with a little bit of deliberate effort, a person could dial that down 2 or 3 or 4 notches within a day or two, actually. Certainly within a week or two. And,
wow,
you know, I've been a therapist a long time. It's, I think, made me nicer, but it's made me tougher. You have to make little efforts. But already, for example, 20 minutes of meditation, that's a very significant intervention in a person's life. You're really doing something there, let alone twice a day. And so I would say that if a person, hypothetically, let's say, do 5 to 10 minutes a day where you're deliberately relaxing your body. There's plenty of material about that. A term that's often used is progressive relaxation. There's a great body work done by Herbert Benson on the relaxation response. Just deliberately, you know, 5 to 10 minutes a day, calm and relax. Second thing to do, take 1 to 5 minutes a day and write down one or more of the key beliefs that make you more nervous than you really need to be. Try to pull them out, you know, the basement or the kind of the back room of your mind. Move them forward into the light. Write them down on a little piece of paper, then draw a line down the, you know, the other side of the paper and list 3 or more rebuttals to that thought that makes you more nervous, more worried, more anxious than you really, really need to be. Do that, you know, for 1 to 3 to 5 minutes a day. And then I'd say, you know, take some kind of action deliberately every day that addresses something you're worried about, right? If you did those 3 things, that's Rick's prescription here, you know?
That's great.
Calm the body, challenge the negativistic thought. They call them pathogenic beliefs, beliefs that create pathology, you know, including garden variety, just not being happy, you know, things not quite right. Not
right.
So much serious, but still real.
So right? Like our saboteurs.
Yeah. Our saboteurs or, you know, the internalization of that fault-finding parent or the critical kid brother or that coach who is really demeaning to you when you were young, you know, or you know, that person who said, I told you so when, you know, something bad happened. Yeah, those voices inside our head, standing up against them. And then, you know, the last thing is take some kind of action, you know, bind your anxiety by, like, do your A priority first, right? A kind of common sense advice. Yeah, I think if a person did that, which would take less than half an hour a day, probably closer to 15 minutes a day, if they didn't experience a pretty significant change in a week or two, you know, then I'd be really interested. And you know, it might reveal a deeper issue at work, something more fundamental, you know, in the body that just makes a person more anxious than they really need to be, say. But in general, I think that, you know, you can do a lot about fear. I pay a lot of attention to subtleties of fear. And I'll tell you another practice I do, Clayton. It's one of the most powerful I know. It's deliberately recognize again and again and again that right now you're all right. Right now you're all right. You may not have been all right in the past. You may not be all right in the future. But if you look retrospectively, most people's lives, 99% of the seconds of their life, they were actually basically okay. It wasn't a $1 million moment, but they were fundamentally okay. Nothing terrible was happening in that second. They weren't in terrible pain. No one was terribly attacking them. No terrible thing was happening to someone they loved. In that moment, they were basically okay. And yet we miss those moments again and again and again that are right under our nose, that are such an opportunity to register emotionally, rationally, based on what's objectively true, that in this moment, your body is basically okay. There's enough air to breathe. You have enough water to drink. You're not dying. You're okay.
Yeah. Would you make the argument then that really most of our fears and anxieties, other than the bear attacking us, are just pure fiction?
I think for most people, it's true for me. Most of, what's the thing Mark Twain had?
I was just thinking that. Yeah, right.
Do you know the exact quote?
I'm going to look it up.
Most of the terrible things, or Oscar Wilde, or somebody witty like that, never actually happened. Yeah, I think that's true. And I want to be really clear. I'm not saying we should ignore real threats. Actually, what I've seen a lot is people get so flooded with little threats that they lose track of the big ones, especially the long-term, slowly accumulating threats, like a long-term health issue or an interpersonal issue or not moving forward in their career. We're not saving enough for retirement, partly because people are so distracted by the little threats that they don't need to worry so much about. Absolutely true. And I think that part of it is very poignant. We have what I call delusional anxiety. What I mean by that is that it's interesting to observe. There you are in your own living room or whatever. You're in a perfectly safe environment, or you're walking down a street. It's a broad daylight, Park Avenue, New York City, something, or wherever you are. And still, there's this subtle background worry or anxiety. It's very strange. And I think it's because it keeps animals on their toes. In other words, to have a background of anxiety that has no real purpose, no real reason for it, keeps you on your toes for that one thing in 1,000 that might eat you, right? And that made sense as we were evolving. But as humans today, most of that anxiety is like a car alarm. It's a false alarm. It's not telling us anything. And it's burdening us, robbing us of joy in this life, and often leading us to do things that are alarming to other people because we feel alarmed ourselves. So I don't like being pushed around. I don't like being a puppet. I don't like having Mother Nature pull my strings, making me more anxious than I rationally, objectively need to be. And so for me, it's a little bit about having moxie inside to speak against the kind of fear mongers, inside our own head, and also, of course, speak against them, outside ourselves, like in groups a lot, relationships. It's very often the case that one person is playing on the fears of another person for various reasons and stirring up anxieties, making others feel unsettled, uneasy, on the bubble, on probation all the time. And it's not fair. It's not right. And actually, if you kind of call that other person on it or see through the ways they're trying to, my parents, they grew up in the Depression. My dad grew up on a ranch. He had friends die in accidents. They were understandably really worried. But man, this pervading field of concern. I just had to realize, I got it. You're worried about that stuff, but I don't need to be.
Here's the quote. I found it, and we could round it out with this. So a lot of people think that it was Mark Twain, but apparently it probably wasn't upon research. So the earliest known quote of this was, it looks like it was president-elect at the time, James Garfield, who was discussing the large number of tasks that he would be facing as president. And it was a statement that says, I'm an old man and I've known a great many troubles, but most of them never happened.
There you are.
There you go. So fascinating. This has been wonderful. And before we go, I think we have a lot of really actionable things. Are there any other things you would add to this, or did we cover all of the actionable steps that we could take to try to mitigate fear and anxiety?
I would say one more thing. Is to learn a little bit about it. It's a profound and primal emotion. And there are good people who've done work on extremes of anxiety, like trauma, that can tell, that have lots of useful information, certainly for extremes like PTSD, trauma, devastating car accidents, being assaulted, whatever it might be. People like Peter Levine and many other people who have researched this territory have a large body of work that's really useful for anybody listening here who has issues like that. And also more generally, you can learn a lot about anxiety, read a little book, learn a little bit about stress, pop open Wikipedia on anxiety. It's kind of like having an owner's manual. Right. We're designed to be anxious. Okay. We're designed to acquire anxiety, not just be innately anxious. We're designed to acquire anxiety and to learn anxiety from our life experiences. And then as you understand a little bit of the mechanics of that, kind of like the 411 level of it, just the basics. But as you do get the basics and you know more about how your body works and your mind works, then you can see it becomes more impersonal. You don't feel so much like it's my fault or ashamed because I'm still nervous as a middle-aged man, let's say, or woman. And also, by learning a little bit about how anxiety works in yourself, you can do things about it on your own to make it better.
Fabulous. Wonderful. And you have a great program, which we talked a little bit about before for those. And if you haven't listened to Rick's previous episode, I would love for you to go back and check out the episode that we did on happiness. But you have a great program on your website. Tell us about how people can learn more about the program and how they can take action.
Oh, thank you. Very briefly, it's an online experiential program. There's nothing like it. It's comprehensive. You can do it at your own pace, in your own time. You know, if you gave it about an hour a week for a year, you would cover the whole program. Sometimes people do go faster or more slowly. I've got tons of guest experts in it, top tier authorities, like Peter Levine on trauma, for example, or Barbara Fredrickson on positive emotions, or Jack Kornfield on mindfulness. So these are really top people, and I would invite people to check out the program. And I should add that if money is at all an issue for people, we love giving away scholarships. And you can learn more about it at the at rickhanson.net, rickhanson.net.
Wonderful. Rick, it's been a great pleasure once again connecting with you. And I just love, I love our discussions. We'll have to think of a third topic so we can have you back later in the year.
Oh, I really enjoy Clayton. And, you know, it feels honestly really collaborative. And I would maybe end on just simply the point that if a person feels more, you know, unsettled, uneasy, not confident, right? Not optimistic. If they feel immobilized or kind of stuck, or, you know, this kind of background sense of uneasiness or dread, please know there are so many resources for you. In the conversation Clayton and I just had, other resources out there in the world, there are so many simple, practical, research-proven things you can do to start feeling better today.
That's wonderful. I love it. So much actionable stuff here. I hope people take notes and really dive in to this, because I think this is one of the most debilitating things we suffer from. But I think one of my biggest takeaways personally was the idea that the feeling of being frozen. And that to me, I'm going to notice that, take that away. I'm going to start to recognize that if I'm just milling about staring out the window and not taking action on something, it's because I'm dealing with a bit of fear and anxiety. And so I've got to nip that in the bud.
That's great.
Really, really great. Rick, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us once again here on the show.
Thank you very much, Clayton.
My thanks to Dr. Rick Hansen for another amazing episode, this time conquering fear and anxiety. Remember, you can reach all of our show notes on our show notes page. Just go to claytonmorris.com/podcast, and there you can see all of the show notes for the Empower podcast. I'm on the road, so if you hear some background noise, I'm out covering the Apple event in California. And so, you know, get a little background noise when I don't have my studio mic with me. So please forgive me, but I'll have a full accounting of the latest from the Apple event on my other podcast that I do with my best friend, Mike Quackenbush. We do that podcast every Monday as well, called the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. If you're into nerd stuff, where we talk superheroes and life, we've been best friends since we were little kids, that podcast you might enjoy also. Thanks once again for dialing us up here on the Empower Podcast. And again, thanks to Dr. Rick Hansen for another amazing episode. We'll be back next week, every Monday, with an episode of the Empower Podcast. Have a great week, everyone. Much love to you.